Last week, Old Testament, pretty cut and dry, if you ask me. I mean, we studied a lot about the Masoretes and their copying abilities, but there was really no concern, so to speak, over its reliability or the canonization. That body material came down to us rather intact. I did find out some other interesting things. I'll bring it up a little bit later on about how later on the church wanted to kind of monkey with the Old Testament and was actually saying we should probably extract a couple books out of the Old Testament, things like Esther and Song of Solomon and Proverbs, because of its many contradictions. And so it was very interesting to read how the church tried to do it, but that body of material was, I mean, it was rock solid. You can't shake the Old Testament. Absolutely 100% reliable. We were able to compare and contrast documents copied over 1,000 years apart and find out exactly how accurate these people were. Absolutely incredible. And no question on what book should be in and what book should be out. New Testament. It's going to be a little bit more slippery, but I don't want it to become something where it's still, in terms of regular literature and in terms of the world, it is still rock solid. It's just not quite as solid as the Old Testament. I hope that doesn't shake your faith. But again, the New Testament was developed in a much, much different way. There was no body of believers out there trying to preserve a body of documents right from the get-go. You got to imagine, Jesus Christ comes on the scene, he lives, he dies, he comes back to life, he appears to a bunch of people, and he says, now go and make disciples, and they start doing this, and shortly thereafter, there was a huge, widespread persecution, and it even says in the Bible that they all had to scatter from Jerusalem, because bad things started happening all over the place. So as these people started going, they still hadn't organized themselves. They still hadn't developed what do we have as our authoritative body of material. Remember, it was a relatively, can I say, new religion, you know, if I could put it that way, but a new religion in that way, that there was no leader, so to speak. There was no pope, no matter how much Catholics would say Peter was the first pope. There was no one kind of running the show. There was a council in Jerusalem that was made up of the apostles, but again, it was a much different thing. The Old Testament, written over about 1,000-year time period. That's a long period of time. The New Testament, written over a person's lifetime. We're talking from 45 A.D. to 100 A.D., I think, is way too long. That's just my personal opinion, but they throw that in there because of the Gospel of John. They believe John and Revelation were written at around 100 A.D. I don't think they were. I think they were written prior to 70 A.D. because there's nothing about the fall of Jerusalem. So I think that body material was written over a 30-year time span. So this is really, really interesting. Now, are there some copying issues? Yes. And you might go online and you might see something. If you recognize this material, yes, I did preach this particular couple next slides way back at the very beginning of Searchlight's existence in a sermon series called Answer This One For Me. So if you're away there at the beginning, you might recognize it, but it's been a long time, Bob. I mean, can you even remember this stuff? You probably could, yeah, because Bob remembers everything. Some people have said that there are over 200,000 variations in the Bible, in the New Testament alone. That, again, is much like what we talked about last week with the Old Testament. Do you remember there where you have the Masoretes, instead of just writing the consonants, they started inserting the vowels, and some of those consonants turn into vowels and are written slightly different? That is exactly the same thing that is happening here in the New Testament. I got some Greek written up here. Anyone read it? No good, because I'm going to astound you here. Ponta diatona geneto ke chorus atona geneto. And then right here, uda en, or there's a variation, and that variation is uden. Uda en, uden. What's the difference? Though you can't read Greek, you could probably figure out what happened from here to here. Yeah, you take out one of the E's, smush them together, and you've got uden. And that happens all the time in the Greek text. Also, there'd be a couple of what we would call variations, which we can easily figure out because of pronunciation issues. There's two different E's in Greek. There's two different O's. There's an Omicron and an Omega. So if someone is talking, you might write down the wrong way it's supposed to be spelled. So, and that happens a lot. If I say, there are two cows in the field and they went there because their master told them to. How do you spell there? I said it three times. How do you spell it? Well, the first one was T-A-T-Y apostrophe R-E. The second one was T-A-T-R-E. And the third one was T-A-T-I-R. And you might be sitting there writing it real quick and you might make a mistake. But you could easily look at that and go, original context dictates that sure enough, this is supposed to actually be written this way. It doesn't greatly affect it. If you wrote down the wrong there, would it dramatically destroy your ability to understand that passage? Absolutely not. And that's the vast majority. They did find out that there are 400 places that are in question, that we go, you know what? We're not too sure how this happened. We're not too sure exactly why it happened this way. We can't explain it because of a slip of a pen, but there's 400 places where maybe a word is out of place, or a word is inserted, or a word is taken out. Some of those places are significant passages in Scripture. If you look at the end of Mark, if you look at the stoning of the woman caught in adultery, or the attempted stoning of the woman caught in adultery, some of those have some huge sections where the earliest manuscripts don't actually testify to it. So that goes into those 400 places. If you give a percentage, that is one half of 1% of the New Testament is in question. 99.5% correct. That, I don't know about you, but that is absolutely amazingly accurate. I did look, Bob. I couldn't find a full chart. Everyone only had what I call a half chart. But what they do is you can actually go into any old body of literature, any old document, anything like that, and you can actually apply a test to it. And that test tries to determine how accurate that manuscript is and how well we can try and get that original back into place. And it measures it on a couple of different scales. The first scale it measures on is how far apart was the original versus the earliest copy. Make sense? So let's say the original was written 2000 B.C. and the first copy we have is 1000 B.C. That would be a time gap of about 1,000 years. If you have a big time gap, will that make you think that there are more mistakes or less mistakes as the time gap increases? More mistakes. It becomes less reliable because you're moving out thousands and thousands of years. If you get a document that is, let's say, 500 years from its original, that would be relatively good. So you could track exactly how well based upon where the copy is, and you can also base on the number of copies. The majority of stuff that we have, things like Pliny the Younger's material, Eusebius's material, all of these people that wrote in antiquity have approximately 3 to 12 copies of their document. So, you know, let's say, because I like Lynn so much and I want to preserve every word the man says because it's awesome, and I write down what he says, and then that gets copied, and I got 12 copies sitting in front of me, I could probably deduce what he originally said. Let's say that 11 copies said one thing, and one copy has something slightly different in one verse. What would you deduce from that? That this guy that wrote this copy maybe slipped the pen, maybe didn't know exactly what to put, maybe heard something wrong, maybe made a contraction, maybe paraphrased. But we have all these others, 11 copies, we could probably figure out what's originally written. That's about the average old manuscript that's out there has a time gap of about 1,000 years and about 2 to 12 copies. There's a document that blows them all away. Homer's Iliad. Check out Homer's Iliad. It was written in 900 B.C., and the first copy we have is 400 B.C. That means we've got a time gap of only 500 years. That is only half of what is out there. I mean, that is really incredible. We can say that that moved that copy back quite a bit. And we have 643 copies that are out there. Do you think we could probably reconstruct Homer's Iliad based and get what was originally written back in 900 BC? We could probably deduce that because we have got such a wealth of material. We've got 643 copies. Well, I lied. There's actually one other document that blows Iliad out of the water, and that is the New Testament. When was it written? I said, they say 40 to 100 AD. I don't buy it. I think it's like 40 to somewhere around 70 AD. The earliest copy, and I'll show it to you in a little while, the earliest fragment we have, 125 AD, which gives us a year of 25 to 60 years. 60 years. That is extremely close. This copy that we have in 125 AD, we believe it might actually be a slightly older than that. And if it is, it could either be A, original, or B, a copy, a direct copy of an original text, which is something that no other body of literature has. It's absolutely amazing. And the number of copies we have, that's a lot of copies. 24,633, and every time we go on to archaeological digs, that number changes. Because originally, when I had first done this, I looked back at my original source, and this was a 24,000. And then it's been updated. As time goes on, more manuscripts are discovered, more fragments are discovered. Now again, not to shake your faith, this is rather impressive, but do remember that some of these, in terms of copies, are not full and complete New Testaments put together. They might be fragments of those copies. So, and I saw a couple websites that said, don't listen to any drivel that someone like, you know, I would say about something like this. These are mainly, well, they're not mainly fragments. Some of them are fragments, but a lot of these are absolute complete New Testaments. Some of them three copies at a time. Absolutely amazing. Which means that if I took all of those copies and laid them out, do you think I could probably deduce what the original said? With 24,000 copies and now with computers? It's incredible. Yes? Some of them are fragments, and that's what I was trying to say. Yes, some of them are fragments. So that means that one of those, you know, one of these will be a fragment. If they have, but there are some that are what we would call complete codexes. Codex Vaticanus, Codex Alexandrius, the Textus Receptus, all of those were, and back in those days, they figured out that if you took a piece of paper, folded it in half, put a string right here, and bound it this way, what could you do? You could create, in book form, something that's a little bit more easier to carry than a big old giant Isaiah scroll everywhere you go. Not quite as easy as the Kindle, but at least they were moving up in the world. Okay? So yes, some of those will be fragments. So it's not 24,000 copies of it. Again, some people start saying, well, wait a second, 125 we have is when they first copy of this stuff. Why didn't they write it down right away? And I read this. Some people say, wait a second, if Jesus was claiming to be God, and if there were people that were following and worshiping Jesus right from the get-go, why didn't they start writing the stuff down and publishing it so that they could create a body of literature to preserve exactly what Jesus said? Why didn't they do that? Well, there was a reason why they didn't do that. Here it is, my only opportunity for you to look in the Bible. Here we go. Only three of you get to talk. Sorry. Oh my gosh, I didn't even write down the text. What are the texts? But they're up on the screen, so you'll see them. What's the first one, Chris? Mark 1, 9. Mark 1. Are you sure Mark 1, 9? Oh, Mark 9, 1. That's a little bit different. See, there's a mistake. You get a little copy. Someone look at Mark 9, 1. Yeah? All right, Joey. And then what? Luke? Luke 21, 32. And Luke 21, verse 20. I need one more, Luke 21:20. Yes, okay, good. All right. I hope you're right. I'm trusting you, Chris. Here we go. It's hard to put my faith. I'm a control freak. Again, why didn't they start writing this stuff down right from the get-go? So, Mark chapter 9, verse 1, while he's reading, here it is right up on the screen. Well, isn't that what? So you're sitting around, you're hanging out with Jesus, and you're like, "Hey, Jesus, what, you know, what's going to be happening in the future?" And he goes, "You know what? Some of you aren't going to die, and you'll see the kingdom of God come in power." Would that, like, excite you to want to write everything down? Or do you think you're to yourself, "Dude, by the time I get it written down and distributed, Jesus is going to come back by that time. There's no way that I could even make it in that short a time." And that's what happened. The earliest disciples didn't write the stuff down, but then all of a sudden, some disciples started dying. And they're thinking to themselves, "That's not good. We need to remember what has been done on this whole time. And so we better start making sure this stuff gets written down." That's the reason why Paul's letters, Romans, 1st, 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, all those letters, those are the earliest copies we have, because he wasn't trying to write down a biography of Jesus. He was just giving them instruction on what Jesus said and how to live out that Christian life. That's the earliest stuff that we have. The Gospels didn't come across later on, because most of them didn't write it down because they thought, "Jesus is coming back. There's no reason to write this stuff down." The same thing also said in the next one, over here, Clady, Luke 21:32. "This generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." Excellent. So why worry about writing things down? But then I have a feeling that what happened was these guys were not the brightest bulbs in the pack. And I think there's even still some today, because Jesus wasn't talking on those particular instances about him coming back for the second time. As you know, when we talk about when is Jesus coming back, we all have this idea that'll be the end of the world. Everything's going to be said and done. It'll be all over. They thought the same thing too. So they thought Jesus is coming back and some of us aren't going to die. It'll be in our generation. It'll be in our lifetime. The problem was they didn't listen to the first part of the book of Luke that preceded this. And give it to me, George. Luke 21:20. Yeah. He wasn't talking about when he was coming back to end the world. He was talking about when he was coming back to judge the people that had destroyed him. And he specifically said, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. Other people translated that, when you see the abomination that causes desolation. It's the exact same thing. When you see that, then you'll know that the end has come. A bunch of the Christians did figure it out. There was not a Christian left in the city of Jerusalem when the Romans sacked it and destroyed everything in 70 AD. Absolutely amazing. So a lot of people took heed and get out. But again, originally, the disciples thought, we don't have to worry about this authoritative body of material. You got to imagine the wealth of attestation that is around and the amount of copies that are there. They eventually figured it out and were able to start copying this stuff over and over and over and over again. What did it look like? I got some pictures up here for you. This is P52. This is the one that's dated 125. So this is the example of a fragment. It's not a complete codex, but it's a fragment. We found out it's called the Rylands fragment. A guy by the name of Ryland, whoever made it significant, so it may not have been the original owner or the original buyer, but the person that figured out that what we've got here is something really amazing, he got his name attached to it. So Ryland's fragment, P52, this is dated to 125. That's that earliest thing that we have. This is a copy of the part of it they've put the text, and they know that this is from John chapter 18, and it was written on the back side, because that's how they started distributing that material. The other thing you got to remember is the amount of persecution that was taking place back in those days. They were actually burning whole libraries. They were finding Christians and saying, "Not only will we kill you, but we'll burn anything you've got." And so again, that's a miracle in and of itself that we have so many copies. That's again how important it was. Check out the next one. This is the Chester Beatty Papyrus. This is three codexes, meaning three complete New Testaments. This is just one page. It's called the Chester Beatty Papyrus. Chester Beatty Papyrus, 250 A.D. Is when they think it was written. So again, they started copying it early on, at least by 125, probably sooner, and then they were making copy after copy after copy in order to preserve what's being said in these things. And then you've got the Bodmer Papyrus, this is 200 AD. It's called P66. And the Bodmer Papyrus contains John, contains Luke, and a bunch of other New Testament books. So the reason why this is important is this tells you that there was copying going on. It didn't happen right after Jesus died because they didn't think he was going to take this long in coming back to get everybody. But once they figured it out, they started copying, they started copying, they started copying. And we have so many copies of it, we can deduce what the original said with 99.5% accuracy. I don't know about you, but that gives me great comfort to know that what I've got there is absolutely reliable and there are no, quote, mistakes when it comes to the transmission. Now, some people then might say, how did we develop these books? Why these 27 books? Now, if you take a look at this, your Bible versus a Catholic Bible, the New Testaments are the same. It's only the Old Testaments that are different. New Testament is the same, but why these 27 books? Why were there other books that were considered? And the answer is yes. Part of the problem is once things started dispersing, everyone started going in different directions. And again, there was no leader to say, here is our authoritative body of material. So we got these people over here, you're the Church of the East, and you all headed in one direction, and you would still be able to talk and get to know each other. And so you developed, you started going through the stuff that was out there. You're like, yes, this is authoritative. Yes, this is correct. Yes, this is correct. Yes, this is correct. These are all correct things. And so you would develop that body of material. And you guys over here in, who are you, the East or the West? You're the East. You're the West. You got the church in the West, and they started developing their thing because they all got scattered. Now, the problem was as those two traditions developed, some of the books were slightly off. You guys believed in a certain body material. You believed in another body material. Then all of a sudden they realized as this thing continues to go and go and go, we should probably develop one body of material that we say, this is what the Christian, this is what the universal, if I was going to translate universal, this is what the Catholic Church actually believes in. And so as they, what would happen is we would start holding these councils. And the, by the way, I'm saying it rather crudely, saying it was East versus West because it wasn't quite that neat and simple. But that's kind of the basic idea. Christians would start gathering at these councils and you would start talking about it because you're like, well, wait a second. We believe in this, this, and this. You're like, wait. We believe this and this and this. Let's come up with what we think is correct. And they did this was through what was called the criteria for canonicity, and it was based on three major things. First off, the books of the Bible had to be apostolic in some way, shape, or form. They had to be apostolic. And what that meant was they either had to be written by an eyewitness or someone who was intricately involved in the eyewitness accounts. So this isn't taking someone 100 years from now and interviewing them on what happened on 9/11. We're talking about people that were actually there and witnessed everything that took place. It had to be apostolic. By the way, this is when they started to monkey a little bit with the Old Testament. They eventually realized, you know what, we're leaving the Old Testament alone because it's been passed down to us this way. But that was these criteria of canonicity. They tried to apply the Old Testament. They realized only the New Testament, what needs to be involved. And that's the reason why you've got Matthew. Matthew was an eyewitness. He happened to be one of the disciples. So was John. What about Mark? Was Mark an apostle? No, Mark was not an apostle. Mark was a scared little young boy that ran naked one time because Roman soldiers tried to grab him because he was running away from the Last Supper. We think it was Mark's house. But we also get it from a reliable source that we are pretty certain that Mark was the guy that literally sat there and wrote it. We would call him the scribe, the secretary, the administrative assistant to a guy by the name of Peter. You could actually say that the book of Mark is actually the gospel according to Saint Peter. And there's actually some internal evidence that helps prove that. I'm not going to go into that. What about Luke? Was Luke an eyewitness? No, he's just a doctor. But who was he friends with? Paul. And what did he do? Well, he started off, he even said, I wrote down to you what I found when I went and interviewed the eyewitnesses. We would call this a biography. I want to learn everything there is to know about Dave Natividad's life. So I'm going to go and interview all of Dave's friends and coworkers and family and all of that. And that's how I developed my material. And they recognized early on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were the four Gospels. And there was never any debate. The East came and said, when it comes to Gospels, the stories about Jesus Christ, we follow Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the West said, yep, we follow Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There was never, ever any controversy, any disputing. No other gospel was ever even considered by those councils. So when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you're getting it from people who lived during that time period, some of them themselves being eyewitnesses to Jesus Christ and his death and his resurrection, saying Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are correct. So whenever you hear of the latest and greatest thing on the History Channel, of course, the most recent one was the Gospel of Judas. And then prior to that, do you remember the Gospel of Thomas? Yeah, Gospel of Thomas. You know, Gospel of Judas. Again, never, ever, ever was it considered. The early church axed it. First and foremost, it was written way too late. It got Judas's name attached to it because if you're trying to write an account to influence other people, and you know that one of the criteria for canonicity is it has to be apostolic, well, then you can't say the gospel according to Bob. No one's going to listen to the gospel according to Bob. Bob, you weren't there. But Bob thinks to himself, I know what I'll do. This is the gospel according to Judas. There we go, because now it's apostolic. Of course, everyone in the room said, that's not apostolic. That's not even close to being apostolic. None of those events actually took place. That would be like me today, at this very moment, writing to you about Abraham Lincoln's assassination. And I have evidence that proves that Lincoln asked Lee Harvey Oswald to assassinate him in the theater. Oh, John Wilkes Booth. Sorry. Lee Harvey Oswald. Yeah. You're like, that's really stupid. Yeah. Jeez. Sorry. John Wilkes Booth. Because that is essentially what the Gospel of Judas says. One of the passages in the Gospel of Judas has Jesus coming to Judas and saying, you know what? You need to betray me, and I need to die at your hands, and you will be blessed by doing that. And so what we find is Judas was just being a wonderfully obedient disciple and killing Jesus. It was written way too late. All of the eyewitnesses said, that's garbage. It never happened that way. Which is why if we unearth any gospel from here on out, it is not, I repeat, not authoritative in any way, shape, and form. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Every early canon, when people started writing down lists, like, gosh, these are the books I follow, all of them, there's one of them, he was a whack job by the name of Marcion who only accepted the Gospel of Luke, but it had to be a redacted thing because he hated Jews. All of the canon lists always list Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There's never any controversy about it. So if we find the Gospel of Mary, there's a Gospel of Mary, by the way, and the Gospel of, I personally like this one, the Gospel according to Adam and Eve. Seriously, Eve is a ditzoid. She is a dork and an idiot. She gets duped twice by the serpent. It's a hilarious story once you read it. And Adam is a typical Jew at that point. He's constantly going, are you kidding me, Eve? You're killing me. Oy vey. It's absolutely, you read it and you're like, this is just comic relief. It's hilarious. Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Judas, Cross Gospel, all of them. None of them ever were considered. So what you have in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are solid. What about Paul's letters? Romans to Philemon. East came and said, this is what we follow. Romans to Philemon. Go east! This is what we believe. In the West, you looked at your documents and you're like, dude, that is exactly the same material we follow. That is authoritative. Because early on, not only were the Gospels, but also Paul's letters were actually bound together in their own codices, in their own little separate mini books, and distributed. And why is that? Well, because Paul was alive around those times. And because people knew Paul, and people could copy that stuff, and Paul's letters were then copied and distributed as a body of literature. There is not one of Paul's letters that is disputed. Not one. All of them are absolutely authoritative, and I've now just gone through about three-quarters, maybe five-sixths, maybe seven-eighths of all of the New Testament. Never been disputed ever at once. Then we get into a little bit trickier stuff because we got the book of Hebrews. And 1 John was always authoritative. No one ever questioned 1 John. No one ever questioned 1 Peter. They said, yep, 1 Peter, 1 John. Those are in, never any dispute. But then you got Hebrews. And you got 2 Peter. And you got 2 and 3 John. And you got Jude. And you got Revelation. And you got the Shepherd of Hermas. And you got the Didache. Those are the rest of the books. When the East and the West and his council started gathering, they said, these are the rest of the books. 2 Peter, 2 3 John, Jude, Revelation, Shepherd of Hermas, Didache. Everyone said, what are we going to do with these books that are left? Because we believe one, and you guys don't quite believe it. On many occasions, it was simply because the copy never got to that tradition. Sometimes, and a bunch of them, they'd say, wait a second, there's a 2 Peter? I've never even heard of a 2 Peter. I'm not saying it's not right, but I would really love the opportunity to investigate 2 Peter and find out if it's authoritative or not. It is named Peter. Peter happened to be one of the disciples. It is apostolic. And it is being used by the church quite a bit. So maybe that should work. The problem was, if you read 2 Peter versus 1 Peter, there's a huge change in the grammar and the style of writing, which is why some churches said, I don't think Peter wrote it. I think it's wrong. So some people said, well, I still think it's right, though. I'm sorry, by the way, I'm on point number I just looked down at my notes. I'm on point number 2 of the criteria of canonicity. It has to be apostolic, and it has to be used by the churches, East versus the West. So this is that church usage thing. Same thing with 2 and 3 John. They read those and go, huh. Oh, I'm sorry, also throw in the book of James. Was James an apostle? Yeah, he was not only apostle, he happened to be the brother of Jesus himself. They called him camel's knees because his knees were so calloused because of the amount of times he prayed. Now, that's pretty amazing when you could say that I pray so much that my knees look like a camel's. Well, yeah, but that's James. But some people said, wait a second, I don't think I really want to follow James because James contradicts Paul. So they thought. And they said, what about Jude? It's a great song. But no, Jude was also the brother of Jesus. But Jude does something interesting. He quotes from a non-biblical source. And they're like, wait, you can't quote from a non-biblical source. And other people said, yeah, you can. There's truth all over this world. I just happen to be quoting it. Same thing with the book of Revelation. Of the disputed books, Revelation was the least disputed, by the way. Yes, Jamie. Oh, I'm sorry. Luke and Acts were always together as a body of material. So yes, yeah. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Luke and Acts were one volume. So those were distributed all together. Yes. So that's why we never had any dispute. So East and West all said the book of Acts are all good. Hebrews sounds a little Jewish. Some people liked it, some people didn't. So all of these materials, they're thinking to themselves, what do we do? What about the Shepherd of Hermas? You guys like the Shepherd of Hermas? We don't. What about the Didache? You've never even heard of these because they've never been in the Bible. But they finally said, you know what we're going to do? This is the body of material that all of us can agree upon, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, all the way down to Philemon, 1 Peter, 1 John. Let's say Those are going to be our authoritative books. And then we draw some votes. And these other books, 2 Peter, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, Revelation, James, Hebrews, all of those make it in, but they are what we call the disputed books. Shepherd of Hermas, Didache, don't make it in. There was just too many problems with them. And you're thinking to yourself, wait a second. So what do we do with these other books of the Bible? I mean, isn't that a little shaky? Well, no, not really. Because of a distinction they used where they called one the set of homolegomena, the other one antilegomena. Before I get into that, I'm sorry, the third criteria for canonicity, it had to be apostolic, it had to be used by the churches, and it had to be orthodox. It had to be true. Remember, we're talking about eyewitnesses here. We're talking about people that knew all these people. And they would read these accounts, and some of them say, it did not happen that way. That's not even close to being what happened. You can do it today. I've done it. I did it this week. It's always a fun little exercise. Go online and type in no plain theory. Do you know that one, Michael? Yeah, no plain theory. You know that one too, Mike? Yeah. The no plain theory is a group of people that are absolutely convinced that there were never two planes that crashed into the World Trade Center. Good for them. Yeah. God bless you. Nut jobs. No planes ever crashed into it. And let me tell you, if you go and watch some of their videos, some of it seems to be rather compelling because of great video work. They put some great music behind it and they have all these things. But it's really hilarious because all I have to do, if I was someone living 1,000 years from now and I say to myself, we got a group of people that say that planes never crashed into it, but we got this other group of people that said the planes actually crashed into it. Where do you think the wealth of information is going to be lying when it comes to the truth? That planes crashed into it. They could go back and say, I wonder if there were any eyewitnesses during that time. I wonder what the eyewitnesses said. What did the eyewitnesses say? There's a plane. And there it's crashing into the World Trade Center. They say to themselves, oh, all of the images, the video images, were all doctored images. And those were actually blown up by the U.S. federal government in an elaborate hoax and a great... Talk about timing. I mean, would you like to be the one holding the button? And then you have to figure out exactly when... the one doing all this stuff, you have to get the plane, and it's got to be, and then you've got to make sure that CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, Fox, MSNBC all have to buy into the lie because they all reported it. And then you'd have to dupe all of the firefighters and all of the police department and every single eyewitness all in that area that actually looked up and saw a plane crashing in there. Absolutely incredible. They have a bunch of other theories too. It's rather amazing, some of the stuff that they come up with. Of course, some people do believe that it was the planes. Oh, yeah, I know, that's right. And then they say, what about that wreckage that we have? Where did the plane actually go to? I mean, there were people on the plane, right? I mean, we have a manifest. Oh, wait, no, we got the FAA in on the whole secret, too. What about the people that died? What about Joe's family? Because Joe was on the plane and Joe died. They must have been paid off. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's incredible, some of the stuff. So that's the reason why if you watch some of these videos, you might say to yourself, that is so not right. It is not orthodox. It is not true and correct because I know people. I've heard people. I watch the footage myself. I can go down and interview it. That's how you know what is right and wrong. And that's why the New Testament church, after they got together, and this was not just one time. This was not one council. This was multiple councils after councils because people kept coming in saying, I really do like the Shepherd of Hermas, and I really want it in the Bible. And they go, well, okay, let's look at it again. What do you guys think? But no, it's garbage. Throw it out. Yes. It started, they think that the first, I forgot which council started first, but somewhere around 200 A.D., and then it kept on going. I mean, tons of different councils, actually. The earliest council of Jamnia in 90 AD, couldn't do it because some of this material was just getting out there. But starting from about 200, and I can't remember which council did it first, but it was in the 200 years. Yeah. And then council after council after council all said, the Bible that you have in your hands is the correct Bible. Back to homolegomenon and antilegomenon. What do we do with these disputed textbooks? What do we do with 2 Peter, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, Revelation, Shepherd Hermes Didache didn't make it in. What do we do with these books? How would you feel if we based all of our belief system on all of the disputed books? Would that make you more comfortable or less comfortable? Less comfortable. If you're going to develop something, you would like to say, what did the majority of people say was authoritative without any question whatsoever? That's what you should develop your doctrine on. And the church, from early on, made that decision and stuck with it completely. They said, if you're going to develop a doctrine, it's got to be A, taken from one of the non-disputed books, or B, if it's taken from one of the disputed books, it better be authenticated by one of the non-disputed books. A huge check and balance, that way you don't come up with some weird, wacky doctrine. I mean, how would you like it if I created a whole religion based on one of the passages in the book of Revelation? I could come up with a really cool religion. It would be really fascinated, seven-headed dragons, you know, bulls and wrath and, you know, the whore of Babylon and things like that. I mean, there could be really, really good stuff that's out there. But I can't do it just on that. It has to be from the whole body. And if it's in the book of Revelation, whatever is in there, better be attested to in the other books. And that's the reason why even today, if we come up and you find the letter of Barnabas or other letters that were written back in those days, you don't have to worry about them. Whether they were original or not, whether they're authoritative or not, because that church in those times, it was not a bunch of religious nuts. It wasn't a bunch of religious power-mongering people who were trying to oppress the people in order to keep them under the thumb. This was the people themselves developing these councils, making these authoritative, saying this is what is true and what happened and what is right. Yes, Lynn. Yes. Yes, and that's what I was hinting at before. If I was going to translate the word Catholic, I could simply say universal. Because that's what Catholic meant, was all-encompassing. That's the reason why the first church was a universal Christian church. And so they said, we are universal, so we shall call ourselves the Catholic Church. And that went on for thousands and thousands of years. And as we know, monopolies are not usually good things. And when you start mixing those monopolies that don't have any checks and balances with political power as well, as we all know, popes and emperors got a wee bit cozy, things can get corrupted. And that's the reason why when Martin Luther came on the scene, everything started to change. But yeah, that's why I don't have any problems talking about the Catholic Church back in those days, because it was a universal church. It was the only church. They had a monopoly. They were the only players on the block because we wanted to have a nice unifying thing that governed our system. Yes, Alex? I think it was nailed down earlier, but go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you got to imagine that early church faced a lot. I mean, when you talk about persecution, people are dying. If you were a Christian, you could be dead quite quickly. I mean, Paul was the first one to start the whole thing, but then it was, you know, time after. So if you were a Christian, how can an underground church back in those days communicate with each other? No tweets, no cell phones, no Facebook updates, you know. You can't do any of that stuff. So, yeah, the persecution caused the church to stay underground, and that's why different groups of people developed different canons, different Bibles, but then were able to get these councils together and be able to nail down then what is authoritative, what is true. Right. And just because something wasn't officially canonized doesn't mean that it wasn't true scripture and authoritative. So that means when you pick up the New Testament and you start reading through those books, you are reading through a body of material that Christians have agreed on for thousands and thousands of years, and that these books were proven by the actual eyewitnesses and people connected to that in order to create that material. Which means if people say that it's unreliable, it's absolutely wrong. They say that, how do we know which books should have gotten in and which books should have gotten out? And maybe if things would have happened differently, we would have had the Shepherd of Hermas and we would have axed out the book of James. Doesn't matter, because what happened there was those people developing it at that time said this is authoritative, which means read the New Testament with confidence, knowing full well that it is authoritative, it is correct, and it is reliable. Let's pray. Lord, again, thank you for your word. And Lord, I pray that all of the heady stuff, the academic stuff would still seep down deep into our brains. And we know that Christianity is not just, it's not just for stupid people who need a crutch to follow you, but there's intelligence behind this, that it's true and it's right. And I pray that you would continue to have our confidence built up in the scriptures so that we, when we read it, we can know that we are following your word, that we are following what you would want in our life. And then give us the courage to be able to follow through on our own lives, to not only read what the scriptures have to say, but then to make it happen in our own life. And I thank you, Lord, that people back in those days wrote down what happened to Jesus, that he lived and that he was crucified, and then he died, was buried, and then on the third day, he rose again from the dead. And I pray that our faith would continue to grow, that as we study your word, whether it be in 1 Samuel or anywhere else, that we would have complete confidence in what you have written. I thank you and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.